Are you serious? And this is my show.
It was in 1937 that the Germans invented methadrine. We tend to think of fascism as something that immediately comes out of the far right. But actually, there are various analyses of fascism that would see it almost as a kind of rogue or heretic Marxist movement. Sure.
Think about your identity. After you've been trained and you've gone through the process of like hunting humans and killing them and, you know, disrupting entire societies, and then you have to come back
and just sort of behave.
The Confederate soldiers' reaction was very similar to the German soldiers' reaction to the communists.
When I taught a course online, Question Authority course, I had people read one of Mussolini's earlier essays.
Maybe the prototype for fascist movements comes out of the United States with the Ku Klux Klan. He thinks that might be the very first indication of something like fascism.
Wait, didn't Hitler have only one ball?
Hitler was afraid of farting and would go to great lengths to prevent that.
Nazis on speed.
Scott J. Thompson is with us today to talk about this and other delightful topics. And I look around me today and I see Steve Robles and Jeff Deal over there.
Yeah,
it looks like he's Googling around or something.
Something. Skydiving plane crashes, killing six. Boy, there's some irony
in
that.
Don't you love that?
That's hot news.
The plane crashed, man. That's how they died. They didn't die jumping out of the plane.
Yeah.
They died in the plane.
Are you going to skydive once before you
die? So maybe you were the guy.
I'm going to die.
Listen, wait.
I'm going to skydive on my 80th birthday, just like George H.W. Is it H.W.? The elder Bush?
Yeah,
didn't he skydive on his
80th
birthday?
So what's that like? Next year?
That's kind of a skull and bones thing, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, does that mean you're a skull and bones guy?
I'm a bones and skull guy, actually.
I think you're a bones and skull fuck kind of guy.
I'm a skull fucker.
Really, though, man, if you were the guy who was afraid to jump out of the plane because you thought you'd die?
Oh, you know what?
That would be me.
Yeah,
and then the plane crashed.
And you'd be the jerk off who'd thought of it in the first place, and believe me, you'd be hearing it all the way down. Yeah. Nice idea.
Great concept.
Yeah. Who's the schmendrick that thought of this?
No, I'm not into jumping out of planes.
Yeah, I am not. I'm actually afraid of heights.
I'm terrified of heights.
I'm a bunch of pussies. I'm not afraid of heights. I'll do dangerous things. Just jumping out of a plane seems
silly. Would you jump from one high rise to the other or something
I'd
like
bungee
that?
Jump. I haven't done it yet, but
Not just afraid of heights. I've got vertigo, just like in that Mel Brooks movie.
I do too.
Just one other way in which your life is like a Mel Brooks movie.
Yeah. Like, seriously, my knees will buckle. And it's so bad that if I were to see, not only am I afraid to, like, look off of balconies and hotels and high rises, if I was to see you, like, sit up.
Oh, you're worse than I am.
Yeah, sit up on the, like, if I see somebody else do that.
Yeah. In movies, I start to freak out.
Yeah, I'll just go nuts.
These seem like symptoms of your growing mortal fear.
No, that's a whole other thing. But I've always
you just have general horrors. You're experiencing general dread.
That's
marijuana talking.
No. I've always been like, I've always had vertigo ever since.
By the way, why are you
kid.
Sitting at that mic? You're at the wrong mic.
Oh, no, he made room for our upcoming guest.
Yeah.
Nice try.
Yeah, I'm right. Nice try. But in the last couple of years, I've got this weird neurosis. Like, I never had, like, just in the last 5 years, I never used to be neurotic in any way. And, like,
yeah, because you're getting old. That's the thing.
Is that what it's like?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I was neurotic when I was younger because I was so fucked up that neurosis wouldn't have even been an issue.
Well,
there was no time for neurosis.
Quaint. And,
neurosis neurotic.
Was kind of something cute that happened to middle class people, I think.
Oh, no.
Now I am a middle class
person. You just take your neurosis for granted, man. Yeah. New York Jew that's got neurosis built right in.
Yeah, absolutely.
there's no escaping
your fate. Don't even think about neurosis. I'm actually only neurotic about being late is really my only neurosis.
No, being laid?
Yeah, no, being laid. I'm not. I probably have all kinds of problems about that. But,
I've got this weird thing where, like, if I empathize with other people's impact. Like, here's a good example. Jeff's girlfriend. I saw her. I had just told her about this weird thing. And I saw them wrestling around on this hardwood floor, and her knees banged up against the hardwood floor, and I just go, ugh! It's insane.
You're an empath.
Yeah, I'm like the hot chick from the Star Trek Next Generation. You know,
it's the marijuana
the
talking.
I think either that or you're...
say that's pretty much about everything.
No.
You're experiencing.
You're just a giant aging pussy.
All right, we're here with Scott J. Thompson. He's the director of research at the Walter Benjamin Research Syndicate, and he's taught several courses at New College of California, including The Virulent Phoenix, The Theory and Practice of Fascism. And he's translated many classic books, including Tales of Transformation by Goethe, and the classic On Hashish by Walter Benjamin. And he's currently translating Nazis on Speed, Drugs in the Third Reich, a collection that he also contributed to as a writer. And he's got his own talk show on KPOO in San Francisco. I hope you'll introduce me in a much briefer manner when I come on your show. He says that his most important work is Sefer Yetzirah. And a commentary on it by Saadia Gaon. And I'm not even gonna. Maybe we'll get to that. I don't know. But
that's a tough one.
I know it's important, but what's more important is Nazis on Speed. Let's give our audience a big kick. Everybody kind of knows that there's a history of the Third Reich and Methodrin. In general, what's sort of the story of Nazis and Speed and Nazis and drugs and so forth? How did they start to get involved with meth?
Well, actually, it was in 1937 that the Germans invented methadrine.
Right.
Benzedrine had been invented in the United States just prior to that time, and it was being sold in retail in Germany. And a group of people, let's see if I can give you the... and give you the names of the people. Hochschild, Dobke, Keil, and Temmler were the ones that synthesized methamphetamine in 1934 and in 1937. And it was branded by Temmler, who was a pharmaceutical manufacturer before, during, and after World War II, under the brand name Pervitin, P-E-R-V-I-T-I-N. Looks like Pervitin.
A lovely name for it.
Yeah, perfect, huh? And it was sold in what looks like, you know, Rolaids form, like a round tablet.
And this was considered to be, most drugs, it's a cure-all at first.
Well, you know what they patented it as was an anti-soporific. It's not dishonest. It was meant to keep people awake. Basically. Mm-hmm. And the army very quickly realized that it would be a way of getting maximum performance out of soldiers, so that it was also patented not just as an anti-soporific, but as a performance enhancement chemical. So that at the same time that there was basically under Hitler a war on drugs, and there was actually an office for the War on Drugs.
There was also a war on drugs.
This was precisely, and this is the dialectic behind this whole book, because it looks at drugs from many different perspectives in Germany before and after Hitler, with regard to the war against personal pleasure drugs,
right,
such as marijuana, opium, morphine. In fact, morphine became a kind of catch-all term for any kind of drug that removed an individual from society into his or her own kind of private world of dreams. That was considered
forbidden. But actually, there was a member of the Third Reich who was a morphine addict.
Well, that was Hermann Göring.
Göring,
who is described in Inside the Third Reich by Albert Speer, arriving to his kind of parlor in like a negligee, supposedly very, very strung out at the time. But anyway, Nazis on speed.
But a brilliant strategist.
Brilliant strategist. He was also a great lover of fine music.
He had a beautiful singing voice, as a matter of fact.
And the large-scale experimentation with speed on the Nazis was they used it on their soldiers. They discovered that it wasn't a good thing to give them every day, because they started... It started having more of a negative than a positive.
Well, that's really great that you've mentioned that, because I sent you ahead of this interview. I sent you a copy of this an article. One of the more interesting articles that's in the book is by a guy named Wolf Kemper, who's a modern writer, called "Pervitin: The Ultimate Victory Drug," and he talks at great length about the use by the military. But his analysis is basically, at the end of the war, the German army was just totally exhausted.
They had no teeth.
Yeah, man, and hearing all kinds of crazy things in their head. Oh God!
And Hitler himself was a fan of these drugs.
Yeah, I thought
this
maybe
may
you would let me just
impacted on his decision making process.
I thought maybe you would just let me read briefly.
Absolutely.
From the little section in this about whether or not Hitler was addicted. This is what this particular guy says. He says, when stressful situations in the Führer's headquarters demanded a suspension of the wake-rest cycle, Pervitin consumption could last several days. Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Theodor Morell, who monitored the consequences, became convinced that stimulating substances were to be avoided and that vitamin preparations were to be dispensed instead. But despite his misgivings, his recommendations went unheeded. During the time...
The guy knew what he liked.
When the German troops encircled in Stalingrad had received the orders to maintain their position, though their defeat was already foreseeable, Hitler wrote a letter of condolence to a family he had known personally. This letter, according to this guy Kemper, provides insight into his psychological and physical condition at that time. It was considered improper in that day and age to write such personal lines with a typewriter. The reason why he was nonetheless obliged to do so, however, Hitler, in his letter, explains as follows, and here's the quote from Hitler. I would have preferred to write it personally, but the long war, sleepless nights, and many concerns have made my hands so shaky that I feared you might not perhaps have been able to read what I would have written.
So the shaky hands being a characteristic of methamphetamine, also explaining why he didn't operate on another characteristic of methamphetamine and writing a really long letter, like explaining like why he said one thing like over and over again in 100 different ways.
Right after taking the typewriter apart.
Right. Taking it all apart and putting it all back together to make sure that little mistake was not right.
Now, do you see any implicit ideology in speed, say, as compared to hashish or something like that? I mean, here we have a Superman ideology, and we have people cranked up, and, you know, during the good part of a stimulant experience, you do feel like a superhuman.
Well, precisely. I mean, the article that I was just quoting from begins with an observation made in a concentration camp.
Right.
Sachsenberg, Oranienburg, and the guy that's describing it is an inmate, and he says that there's this group of inmates, prisoners, that are just circling around and around and around whistling, and that they're basically guinea pigs for a new drug, and they're just going to keep walking and, you know, doing this kind of march until they drop to see how long it will take. That's what they did. And the guy that's writing this little memo, you know, in his notes says the Germans are certainly going to need this. And then the author goes on to say that how after the initial blitzkrieg in Poland and the victories in the West, once there were a few defeats, they were no longer able to just go on coffee and aviator's chocolate and tea. They needed something a little bit more stimulating for longer, more, you know, more heroic struggles. And that's when they started to issue Pervitin. But what's really interesting and is not mentioned in this guy's article, but if any of you have read a book, God, I don't know if I'll be able to remember the guy's name now. It's a recent book on Hitler from a doctor, not the psychopathic God. That's, I can't remember the guy's name now. But this is a recent book written on Hitler. Maybe the name will come
by one of his physicians?
Not by one of his physicians, but by a recent American physician. Yeah. And it's considered, it's a very reputable book. And he felt that if you look at Hitler's conversations and diplomatic dialogue just before the attack on Poland, he felt that there were a couple very important conversations where Hitler is speaking in such a scattered way and in such a style that he's convinced that this was indicative of long-term, that he was already, you know, in a state from using Pervitin at this time. And that might have been part of the Blitzkrieg. It might have been a Blitzkrieg drug, you know.
Now, he was also doing opiates. From what I understand, I saw a...
And he liked cocaine, I guess.
Did he really? What I thought was really funny was that his doctor, Morell, gave him opiates because of his gas problem.
Yeah, had
which is not very smart.
Bull's testicles and grape sugar was another one of Dr. Theodore
he had really bad
favorite concoctions. Hitler was afraid of farting and would go to great lengths to prevent that.
Wait, didn't Hitler have only one ball?
You know, that's a theory that was very, very prominent, and now it's been shot down. People don't believe that. Monorchism.
Maybe
he
shot up into the other ball, actually.
Monorchism?
This was based on the Russian autopsy, and that Russian autopsy of Hitler's corpse is now...
it's suspect.
It's been fairly discredited as of late, but these things...
Maybe Stalin had one ball.
I think Stalin may have
three.
Extra ball.
Stalin may have had
steel
four.
Ball. Yeah. The man of steel. You taught this course in fascist ideology.
Yeah, I taught a course on fascism in college because I was very concerned that the word fascism was being used too indiscriminately, and I wanted students, when they used the word, to know what it actually referred to, not meaning you can't use the word fascist, but I thought instead of just using it as invective or for agitational purposes, that, you know, if you're using it as an analytical word from political theory, it has to refer to something that's not tyranny, that's not, it has to be its own separate thing, and what is that thing? And then I took them through, you know, the history of Mussolini's party, the history of the rise of the Nazi party, and various other fascist movements in Europe. But you know what? There's a book, it's a recent book by Paxton called Anatomy of Fascism, and he thinks that maybe the prototype for fascist movements comes out of the United States with the Ku Klux Klan. He thinks that might be the very first indication of something like fascism.
Now, if you look at the people's comments all over the web over the last few years, there is this meme that's gone out that fascism is basically the unity of corporate power and state power.
Right.
And I would think, yes, but it's also
more to it than that. There's a paramilitary movement involved. It usually follows as a kind of compensatory type of philosophy, not necessarily philosophy, but a compensatory movement for people that they feel defeated. The Germans felt defeated right after the First World War, especially the soldiers, these guys that were in the Freikorps that were kind of undemobilized soldiers that were paramilitaries and didn't want to stop being soldiers. And they were used by the Weimar Republic to fight against the communists and the various uprisings that took place during the 20s. And a lot of those guys ended up becoming members of the Nazi Party.
Right. And then the whole spiritual warrior concept. I mean, there's this really
male. Yeah, it's extremely male, virile kind of thing. We've got to reassert ourselves against the decadent bourgeois and against the decadent socialists who have become compromisers with this liberal you know, illiberal parliamentarian bourgeois that they felt was, you know, the end of their manhood.
I posted when I taught a course online, question authority course, I had people read one of Mussolini's earlier essays, one of his definitional essays, and they were surprised at how much there was that they could agree with, and you know how it sort of has similarities to leftist ideology.
It's like reading the Unabomber Manifesto.
It's a little bit like, you know, that's a very good point. When I read the 1919, you know, the platform that the first fascist party had, they wanted universal suffrage. They wanted women to have the vote. They wanted to tax corporations. They wanted to tax the profiteers of the war. I mean, there are all these things in there that are very populist, and they would appeal to huge numbers of Americans until they realized, you know, where this was going. It's a little bit like Lyndon LaRouche, actually, in the sense that when you listen to some of the LaRoucheites, some of the things they have to say, their analyses, you can agree with them up to the point until they get into some sort of position of power, and then you have to see where the cobblestones are leading
a few feet before them. You know, you have to figure that out.
I think that we should kick back and listen to a tune, and then come back and talk about more joyous topics.
A Germanic tune.
Are you serious?
Und sagt die Zauberwörter Simsalabimbamba, Saladu, Saladimbe. Auf einen gefettetes Backblech legen und bei 200 Grad für 15 Minuten backen. Und keine Eier!
We are back, and let's continue on this fascinating topic of fascism, and in fact, the use of that phrase, fascinating fascism. Susan Sontag wrote a book called Fascinating Fascism, and there is this sort of...
There is this sort of
visceral attraction, not for so much specifically towards fascism, but towards the Nazis, particularly as a mythology that people have, and even people who completely abhor their politics, have sort of a perverse attraction or just a really intense interest in the Nazis. I think part of that is because the people are vaguely aware of an occult connection there. I mean, can you comment on all that?
Yeah, actually, on both of those things. One of the things that's amazing about Nazism and fascism, but particularly the Nazis, is that they were able to mobilize all these apolitical people by giving them a sense that they were participating in something. But what they were participating in was just being orchestrated from the top. They were being manipulated like little puppets from these people that knew how to put them in architectural forms and march them around and let them see what they looked like from way up high. And, you know, they would see themselves as a kind of turning swastika and all of this kind of thing that Albert Speer mobilized as one of the ministers of armaments and so forth. Right. He was very good at putting together some of these light displays. But with regard to the occult part, it was Himmler that was deeply fascinated in the Grail. And there was a guy by the name of Otto Rahn who was also working with Himmler, and he worked in this department called the Ahnenerbe, which is like kind of the ancestral heritage department. And these are the guys that were applying their racism to other cultures and sending very famous anthropologists all over the world to take plaster casts of natives' heads and measure heads and all of this kind of stuff. Well, this guy Otto Rahn and these various anthropologists...
Is he the guy who went to Tibet?
No, he's not the guy that went to Tibet, but you probably saw this KQED, the Hitler and the Holy Grail special. I don't know if you saw it. It's great.
Didn't they cobble together this lineage all the way back to the original Mennonites?
They thought it went back to the Spear of Longinus and all of this stuff.
Were they really searching for...
They were really searching for some of this stuff, and they really thought that this bestowed some sort of... kind of occult power, and you had to have these things. Now
I have the spear. Well, I think I lost.
You have
it,
the spear. Well, that's great. Do you have it? Where can I see it? I've never seen the thing.
I thought I saw it on eBay. Actually, maybe.
Thank God Indiana Jones was there to stop them.
I think that some of the Indiana Jones stuff is actually related to this Otto Rahn.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that he might be the guy that they were basing that on.
I would.
Yeah, the guy whose flesh melted
at the very end. All the spirits come out and start sailing around.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful, all right.
Whether Hitler was really into all of this stuff, I think much less than Himmler. But Hitler was really into the mythology that he had gleaned out of Richard Wagner.
What about the Thule Society?
The Thule Society, Those were the early, the precursors to the Nazi Party, Lanz von Liebenfels and Guido von List and all of these kind of precursors. They were kind of theosophical Nazis before the existence of the Nazi Party.
So you mentioned this, one of the requirements for fascism maybe is this group, this sort of disenfranchised group.
A disenfranchised group that needs to to reassert itself, and they feel that they've been slighted, and to a certain extent they feel that their manhood has been somehow violated and they have to reassert it.
And then the military part, do you think that after any sizable war, when you have like a group of soldiers who've been trained to kill,
this is always a possibility in those kinds of situations when you have defeated soldiers coming back from a situation, it's happening to a certain extent. Some people feel that there's a growing fascist movement in Israel because of some soldiers that have come back from the occupied territory with weapons and their caches of weapons. Some people feel that some of the guys that are coming back from the Gulf War, like Terry Nichols and all of these guys, are potential, these militia, Michigan militia guys.
Just from the first Gulf War that involves very little combat, whereas what we're dealing with now is affecting a lot higher numbers.
When all these guys come back from this line of, this campaign, this tour of duty, they're going to be coming back, with all of these physical defects that these earlier soldiers... in the First World War, people were amputees, a lot of them. These guys are coming back with all this depleted uranium stuff, which, they're giving to their kids, their wives, and all that. But these guys are coming back extremely defeated. They're ending up as the homeless.
They're giving uranium to their wives and kids? Is this like...
This is documented.
Sprinkle.
It's like really horrifying stuff.
Well, to tie it back to you, you were talking about how it's possible that the very first fascist movement was the Ku Klux Klan.
That's what Paxton said, as a kind of archetype, one of them.
And weren't they basically comprised
of... precisely Confederate
soldiers.
That were taking revenge on the people that had been liberated.
And who had had their manhood robbed from them.
You could say that the Confederate soldiers' reaction was very similar to the German soldiers' reaction to the communists. They're analogous situations.
And in fact, that because it wasn't just defeat, it was humiliation. Humiliation was a part of defeat. The Sherman march to the sea is just completely psychological warfare.
Unless you have a situation where these soldiers can come back and have a clear-cut sense of victory, think about your identity, your sense. After you've been trained and you've gone through the process of like hunting humans and killing them and disrupting entire societies, and then you have to come back
and just sort of behave
and then on top of that, if it was a defeat, if it was seen as a just nothing but a waste.
None of us here have any idea what it must have been like to be in the First World War. I mean, that was like the first mechanized war, the first time that you have 60,000 people wiped out with poison gas, the first time you have bombs being dropped on civilian populaces, tanks, barbed wire, all of this thing, and it was... This trench warfare that these guys were in was something that people had not done before, and for them to go back then to their normal job or unemployment amongst people that had no idea what they'd just been through, they couldn't.
Well, of course,
and they didn't want to demobilize some.
The
of these
German
guys.
Fascism came out of defeat. Aside from looking at the what happens to soldiers from Israel and what happens to soldiers from America, you have to look at what happens to civilians in Jordan and in Palestine and in Iraq and all those other places. And oppressed people also tend to create fascist movements.
Well, fascism is definitely... we tend to think of fascism as something that immediately comes out of the far right. But actually, there are... various analyses of fascism that would see it almost as a kind of rogue or heretic Marxist movement.
Sure.
Not exactly a heretic Marxist movement, but Mussolini was a member of the Socialist Party. He was deeply involved with a lot of anarcho-syndicalists.
Right.
And a lot of these guys ended up becoming early fascists because they felt that the only way that they could promote a real revolution in Italy was by promoting the war. They felt if that happened, if Italy got into the war, they felt that that would trigger some sort of situation for revolution. So it's a very complicated beginning of fascism in Italy.
How'd that end up working out for him?
Well, it didn't work out that well.
isn't there like that point where... fascism and socialism, there's this kind of, if you look at it as a circle, there you can get to the extremes of both and you'll reach some kind of like taint.
Well, Stalinism is a form of national socialism of sorts. I mean, it's socialism in one country. Doesn't that mean national?
And
during the Second World War, there were people that looked to fascism in Italy and fascism in Germany, and they saw Stalin as not really being all that far removed, and they saw them all as being very totalitarian. So, post-Second World War, for a long time, these analyses of totalitarianism, like Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, and the guy that wrote The Grand Chess Game, what's his name? He was the national security advisor under Carter.
Brzezinski.
He was one of these analysts of totalitarianism, and they saw Stalinism and fascism as being basically, totalitarianism. They saw it all kind of as one of the same, which I don't think is an accurate representation, but I can see similarities.
Well, speaking of Marxism, we don't have too much time left, but I did want to have somewhat of a chance for you to talk about Walter Benjamin. You do run the...
Well, Walter Benjamin is actually, I'll bring it back. He's actually a figure in this book, Nazis on Speed, because he was involved in drug experimentation at the very end of the Weimar Republic.
Right.
Because he had some friends that were doctors, and they asked him if he would be involved in some of these experiments. And his book, On Hashish, which is actually a bunch of fragments, he had intended to write a complete book that he didn't.
Right.
So what we have of his writings are just fragments that have been collected by other people. But he felt that this was a very worthwhile investigation, and for a long time it's been marginalized until recently, and now more and more people are seeing it as actually being not a marginal element of his work as a whole, but actually a central thing, that it's related to the concept of aura and other things in his writings. But with regard to Nazis on speed and how he fits in, he's kind of that you could say that he represents the opposite pole of this performance enhancement thing. I mean, he represents precisely what the Nazis were against and what they were fighting in their own war on drugs, which was called Rauschgiftbekämpfung, which literally means the fight against intoxicants.
Right.
And there was an office with that name that was, you know, in the Nazi government, in the Public Health Bureau. That's very interesting.
So Benjamin was, in essence, against performance.
Yes, you could say that. He was a psychonaut of the Weimar Republic.
Right.
And a kind of early Aldous Huxley, you might say. His observations are not unlike the Doors of Perception.
Now, he also precedes what's come to be called postmodernism, and he rejected the whole idea of historical progress.
He was one of these Marxists that rejected the idea that things are getting better. And he was a thoroughgoing Gnostic pessimist, you might say. Right. So he feels that, in fact, what we call progress is a gigantic catastrophe, basically.
Right.
I find his work now more and more pertinent because as we approach almost, you know, extinction here on this planet, and, you know, depending on who you're reading, some people say we've got 10 years, 15 years, 20 years before surface life on this planet is just burned to a crisp or we're all underwater or whatever. You know, this idea that everything is getting better, we really do need to take that idea on, I think. And he's a good one to have on your side if that's what you believe.
Well, we were talking in our last show about the idea that Islamic fundamentalists were basically at war with Western civilization. And when we look at that dynamic, we tend to find ourselves actually on the side of Western civilization. Is there a danger in saying, well, you know, the Enlightenment, you know, is not an accurate description of reality, therefore we don't continue discussion around democracy and civil liberties?
Well, with regard to civil liberties and democracy, I still believe in those. I still believe in civil liberties. I still believe in democracy. With regard to where Benjamin fits in on that score, he was a Marxist. He was a socialist. He believed in fighting for democracy. He just did not believe that things were automatically going to get better because of the scientific rationality. He had big questions about that, and he felt that it might have its own mythological underpinnings.
He had interesting ways of talking about and thinking about the mind, and he particularly talked about memory, and basically that forgetting is implicit in remembering. So today people talk about enhancing our memories or bringing back our memories. And I think what they're really talking about is never forgetting, because otherwise there's always this dynamic between forgetting and remembering.
Well, you know, I was listening to an interesting lecture by a guy, I think his name is Malamede. He was at the Normal conference here not too long ago, Dr. Malamede, talking about cannabis and the role that it plays physiologically in the body with regard to receptor sites and the way it controls and various regulatory systems in the body. And it's very key with regard to memory. And all the jokes with regard to short-term memory loss from smoking marijuana and so forth. And he was talking about how absolutely forgetting is an essential part of our life. And if we had to remember everything and could not forget anything, this would just be a nightmare. And many of us that feel, oh my God, I'm starting to lose my mind because I can't remember something. If you remembered everything, just think of the burden that would be. All the things you've ever done, you know, I don't think that I could handle that.
Well, the idea of recall is that you have this kind of latent archive of memories that you can recall when you want. And that's what's most frustrating for me is that when I want to think of something,
there you go,
and I can't, then I write it off as I have a bad memory. But I guess it's maybe one function of memory, the recall part of it. It might be in there somewhere. But.
Well, I don't know if any of you have ever... I bioassayed one time a very strange chemical called ibogaine.
I've not tried it. Yeah.
And that was one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. And there was a moment where I realized that it was all there. You know, everything that I'd ever done. That you could, you could go back. Any little idea, you could rekindle. That this, all these cells were still all there. It was like this sudden realization. Oh my God! You know, they're not dead. They're just dormant. They're latent, and it's the matter of the trigger mechanism for being able to kindle that recall. But it's not gone, you know? That was amazing.
What was the name of that doctor? Malamar?
I think it was Malamede, something like that.
Remember Malamars?
I'm trying to forget.
Maybe some things are worth forgetting.
I think we're good, actually. Oh. I want to thank you for coming in today.
Can I plug my website?
Absolutely, yeah. Plug your website.
For anybody that wants to read, well, Harvard has recently published On Hashish. I could go into a whole separate story on why they didn't publish my translation. That's a whole other show. But the guy that introduced the book, I'm the one that got him to write that intro. And if anybody doesn't want to buy the Harvard book and just wants to read it for free online, it's at wbenjamin.org. All one word, wbenjamin.org.
And the book, Nazis on Speed,
Nazis
is going
Speed
to be an English
Feral
translation.
House.
Yeah,
it's Feral House. It's forthcoming. I think it'll probably be out by January.
Okay. All right. Once again, thanks, Scott Thompson, for coming in. This has been
Great
the Are You Serious
here,
Show.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?